This is the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast from Advanta IRA, where we show you how to explore investments beyond Wall Street and open your eyes to new options for your portfolio. It's time to take control and give yourself the freedom to choose where you invest your money.
Hi, and welcome to another edition of the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast. Today, we are pleased to welcome on Lisa Crosta. I always like to have people that can give a good overview of financial planning in a general sense, because too often I feel in finance, and I am guilty of this myself, is that we tend to lose the forest through the trees. We don't necessarily, we kind of look at the end goal of saying, hey, this investment looks awesome, but you have to have a plan that's going to support all of that if you want to be successful really in anything in life, whether it's a diet plan, whether it is your financial plan, whether it is a plan for a vacation. If you kind of just leave it up to the powers that be, you know, you're not going to set yourself up for success. So today, again, we're very pleased to have on Lisa. She is a certified public accountant, but I'll let her give a little bit of an introduction and her background. We're very pleased to have her on today to kind of cover some of the high points and her thoughts on financial planning and how people can best set themselves up for success. So Lisa, thank you very much for being on with us today.
Thanks for having me, Alex. It's good to be here. Well, I just give you a quick background. I started my career after a couple years of working after college. I was trying to figure out a way to work with people rather than work in a big corporation. I don't know why. That was just, I had this thing. And so I thought, well, let me get my CPA. That's a good way to have a career that I can work with people. So I went back to grad school after college and I took the courses I needed, got my master's and took the CPA and promptly got hired by a really big company. But I asked if I could work in the tax department. And because again, I thought that would be my path. So I started in tax. It was a great starting point. I think every person should do a tax return once in their life. It will answer so many questions and it will, this is not the point of the call, but everybody should do it once. Then I quickly moved up to the personal financial planning department at my first job at Ernst & Young and stayed with that career ever since. And it got me to work with people and working with people and their finances. And so I've always done that. I took some time off with my kids. And when I went back to that career and got the additional licenses, the certified financial planner license and other ones. So it's just, I enjoy it. It's talking to people about things, real life things, their money. And they're so often, people are so often afraid to talk about it and ask questions and afraid to seem that they don't understand things. And it's really, it's a complex world out there, and it's gotten more complex as they've changed the laws and increased all the options for saving for retirement and such. So I just enjoy the conversations. I enjoy helping people get to where they want to get, and understanding your finances is just a good way to start.
Yeah. And I really like to echo that point of, you know, it's a conversation you need to have, and this stuff does get complex. And to people's, you know, kind of trepidation on this, again, you're not wrong in thinking that it's complex for complexity's sake. You know, there's really kind of no better way to put it. The stuff is inherently not made, you know, as easy to understand as I think it really should be. And when you have a professional like myself or Lisa that can kind of at least break it down into its constituent parts, it gets a lot easier to understand. But unless you're someone that, you know, really wants to, you know, dive in and learn this stuff, which I encourage people to do. To your point about doing your own tax return, yes, everyone should do it once in their life. You know, take, you know, a few minutes out of your day or, you know, over maybe a few weeks to kind of just sit there and just, you know, read the high points. You know, it's not inherently too bad. If you're filing a simple return, if you're just a W-2 employee, you don't have a whole lot of extraneous things going on with complicated tax returns and depreciation schedules for things like real estate or large amounts of personal investment holdings, it's not too bad. But at least it'll give you kind of a, you know, a backdoor peek into how the sausage is made on this.
Yeah, and, absolutely. You
know, that can get as granular as you want it to. But you know, to your point, when it kind of comes to, you know, opening up the curtains and taking a look at this, you know, it's always good to start at the beginning. You know, we have to build this pyramid of success, you know, one brick at a time, and you don't start at the narrow tip. You have to start with a wide base. So when it initially comes to your perspective of talking to people and at least getting their minds opened up and being ready to accept maybe taking a little bit more franchise in their financial futures, whether that is simply just, you know, setting up a financial plan or saying, hey, look, I've saved a good amount of money. Now we need to start investing and setting up for the future. What are kind of some of the first steps that you like to take with people to help, you know, bring this down to a digestible level?
So we try to always start with a cash flow. And to do that, we have to get some information. So there's a little bit of lift on the client side. But again, it's one of the things we can do it on a bigger picture, we can do it more granular, depending on what the client's comfortable with. But the goal is to get down to, at the end of the year, and clients think more monthly generally, so we can even say at the end of the month, are you net positive or are you net negative? And so to get to that number, we look at all the money that's coming in. You know, you may have rental income, you may have just W-2 income, you may have some self-employment income, whatever it may be, and if there's a spouse for both of you, and what are you spending it on? And, you know, some clients send me 100-line spreadsheets of expenses, and some clients give me one number. So I don't really care as long as the number is accurate. So when we get those numbers, and I mean, I like to have some detail, then we can say, okay, look, it looks like at the end, and again, the software looks at it and we look at it yearly, but I know clients tend to think more monthly, but let's say at the end of the year, it looks like you're net positive. I'm just going to make a number up, $12,000. So I think it looks like at the end of each month, you probably have about $1,000 at the end of the month. And right there, clients, you could, that's your first checkpoint. They're like, oh my God, no way. I'm usually trying to hold on to my next pay. You know, I can't wait till the next pay comes. I'm never positive. Or no, I have more than that. So the point of this is to figure out, first place, where are we, right? We can't get anywhere until we know where we are today. So, okay, let's get this figured out. Let's figure out where we are at the end of the month. With that information, can you get to the goals you're trying to achieve? There's usually something you're trying to achieve. It may very simply be, you know, retirement in 10 years. It could be to buy a second home. It could be to get a kid through college. It could be to quit this job that you hate. But we can't get there until we see where you are today. So say whatever it is, okay, you're saving this much a month. You have this much extra. What's it for? You know, I'm not into saving money just to squirrel it away and have the biggest pile in the bank. Although that could be some clients' dreams. And if that's their dream, we're going to help them get there. But what are we trying to use this money for? And what are we trying to get to? And are we on a path to do that? And if not, what do we have to do to get on that path? And, you know, I've had clients say to me, I was afraid to show you my stuff. I'm like, I'm not here to tell you to not go out and buy coffee in the morning, if that's what you want. I'm not here to tell you how to get to where you want to be. And it might be, listen, you need higher income. You need to ask for a raise. You need to look for a new job. You need to, maybe some places it's spend less, or you need to get rid of that investment property that's a loss for you. And you think it was a positive until you put all the numbers together and you realize you're losing money on it. So there's so many different ways for an individual ways where people can, you know, where they are today into where they're trying to get. So it's not always a question of just spend less. I would much prefer to figure out how for you to make more to get to your goal. So that's the starting point.
Yeah, and that's a good point that you make of it's not necessarily spend less, but how can you make more? You know, we don't necessarily need to live in this, you know, austere bubble when it comes to finance. You know, you can there, you know, you only get one life and you don't get any, you know, more minutes added onto that. So how can you enjoy them? You know, it's one of those things. It's don't sell yourself short today for a, you know, goal that you haven't even reached yet. Now,
and you kind of just really quick, I just want to, if I got on that note, is some people are such savers that they're not enjoying their life. And sometimes coming to a planner, a lot of times it's a spouse, right? One wants to save, one wants to spend. When you come to, and they can spend, you come to a planner, they're given the permission from somebody outside to spend money on maybe what that partner wants to spend on, because there's enough money to do that. I can't tell you how many times we've done that. And the arguments stop. And now they realize, oh my God, we can go on that vacation. We can pay for our grandkids to do this. And they know they can do it. So it's another great reason to come to a planner.
Yeah, it's financial therapy. If if you'll go to therapy to improve your own franchise in life, you go to a doctor to improve your health. Yeah. Why not go to a financial planner to help improve your finances?
Absolutely.
You know, we often look to saying, hey, you know, we'll take financial advice and expert advice from so many other areas, but when it comes to finances, we want to wall that garden off. And you really shouldn't. It's you know, part of this I'd like to talk to a little later on is, you know, how to kind of break down that stigma a little bit, because it gets, you know, finance gets so stigmatized. It's either, you know, I don't know where it comes from. I would say it's probably generational of anything. But today, you know, it's always, you know, the big social media, keeping up with the Joneses, and just trying to, you know, break that down and say, hey, look, let's focus on ourselves. Let's figure out what our goals are and how we can get there. And everyone kind of has a different flavor. And that's what I want to get into, is that flavor that you try to put out there of, you know, your take on setting up these plans. Now, you mentioned goals, and that's, on any of the financial planners or people in the financial planning space that I've talked to, that's a big one. And something that I've kind of, you know, taken from each individual person is that, one, they have a different take on it, and I'd like to get yours. But one common problem I see is that some people, you know, kind of have an overabundance of goals sometimes, and maybe they don't have enough in other times. So maybe kind of getting your take on saying, okay, how do we kind of set those goals? And maybe, you know, should we only focus on one? Should we have a few? And then, you know, how many is kind of too many in that, you know, initial setting of goals? And, you know, maybe what are some of those as well? Yeah.
And that's where a plan helps, because it's really hard to do three goals in the back of an envelope. You know, it's like, so most clients have more than one goal. I mean, I'd say for most, there's a retirement goal out there. It could be, depending on their age, it could be far out in the future, but we know the time value of money, the power of compounding over time. So we can't just wait to save to retirement when we're 5 years out. So, you know, when we do a, when I do an initial call with a client, I always say, what are the three most important things right now? And so everybody's different, obviously, but we can work, you know, I'd say the most common things I see is the retirement goal, and not just the retirement, that you can live through retirement comfortably, right? It's not just a flip the switch and we're done. Usually there's a college education in there for some kids. And then the third goal may be to be able to take a vacation or do something that they want to do that maybe they're not doing. So we'll put in expenses, like we'll put in annual expenses for what that's maybe not in the plan. They didn't give it to us. So what's your goal? You want to take, you want to spend $10,000 a year on vacation. Let's put it in the plan and see what it looks like. Let's put in the years your kids are going to college, how much you have saved already. And then we have a separate education piece we can pull out and look at it and say, okay, with the way you're saving now or what you've currently saved, you're going to be able to fund 33% of your kids' education. So then we talk about what are the other options? Saving more. But if there's no money left to save, if they're saving for retirement and they really can't pull back on that, and they don't want to wait to live, they still want a little bit of money for vacation, we talk about how are the other ways to pay it. You know, kids can take out loans. There's some great, I always talk about the first layer of loans, which every child can get regardless of income, regardless of parents' assets, are the federal Stafford loans. And they're the best interest rates out there. So they total over 4 years, $27,000. It's just what the government gives them. So I'm like, okay, if you're comfortable with your kid having that, we can take that out. Let's put $27,000. It's not a lot over 4 years, but listen, it's something. And then there's other means of loans. There may be, you know, you may be in a higher, you may be making more income by time your kid retires, by time your child goes to college. So maybe you can use $500 a month to help supplement it. So we talk about all those different ways. But I mean, I've been on calls with clients and said, listen, you're done with your 529s. Stop putting money into them. You have more than you need, or you're not going to get there. So keep what you're doing. And let them and we'll talk about the other ways to fill that gap that needs to be filled, but there are ways to do it. But you know, we are hesitant to have people not save for retirement in lieu of college, because we know you can borrow for college, you can't borrow for retirement.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's definitely a good point that you bring up, is that, you know, understanding the principal factors that go into achieving those goals. And that's something I've actually kind of heard someone put out there before, but it certainly rings true, is that you can certainly, you know, borrow and finance an education. You can't, it's hard to borrow and finance your retirement to any meaningful degree. Maybe if it comes to buying a new house, you need to get a mortgage, or, you know, a few different things. But on a grand scale, you know, you have to have that nest egg, you know, kind of in place by the time that you want to say, hey, you know, Mr. Boss, I'm done. Yeah. So again, that's kind of an interesting perspective. Now, when it comes to, you know, figuring those two things out, would you say that retirement and education are kind of the two main drivers when it comes to, you know, looking at people's financial plans? And does that vary, you know, at all between the different types of people that you talk to, whether that's, you know, people in certain sectors, whether that's people in certain demographics, men versus women, you know, where do some of these kind of goals, you know, tend to align more or less?
So I'd say those are two really common goals. The other common goal is to leave money to kids. You know, we can actually build in a nest egg and see if we can make the plan work. So say they want to leave $1 million, you know, let's put that in and see how the plan works. So leaving money for kids or helping grandkids is often a big one. We see that more a little bit later. You know, we don't see that too much when people are still trying to get their kids through college, but their kids are older and they're later in their career. That sort of takes over for a lot of people. That becomes, replaces the college stuff. Right now they're older, so they may want to have some money set aside. You know, they may use insurance to do it, or they may just set money aside. But this comes back to like the clients that want to, one client, you know, just doesn't want to spend any money. They want it all to go to her kids. And the husband's like, come on, we can go on vacation. So we're working with them to balance that. But, you know, there's a point where people have enough money that they're not really saving for retirement anymore, right? They may just be working because they love their job. I mean, there are people out there that have made plenty of money, and you know, they're not focused on retirement anymore. That once you get that nest egg big enough, the goals turn to estate planning. How do I minimize my estate taxes when I die? And how do I make sure everybody's set when I die? And die prematurely or die, you know, at the end of my life expectancy. So we spend a lot more time when the assets get bigger on the planning aspect of post-death, I guess is the best way to say it.
Sure. Yeah. So again, that's kind of a good way to look at it for, you know, maybe kind of the general avatar of a lot of people when they start thinking about financial planning. But that's not to say, and that's, let's just call it a married couple, yeah, you know, a person and their spouse. Mm-hmm. But I don't really think that kind of paints the whole picture of people that need financial planning. There's plenty of people out there that are single, or maybe they are, you know, still out there, you know, maybe dating or, you know, engaged. And there's also people on the other side of that that have dealt with divorce as well. So maybe let's kind of break that down. We've kind of looked at that middle section of the married couple. You know, they're going to have, not to say single people can't have children. Certainly there's plenty of them out there, but, you know, the general goals of, you know, when people kind of look at, you know, the white picket fence, the 2.5 kids, the golden retriever, but that's certainly not everyone.
Not everyone, not these
by any stretch of the means. You know, my wife and I don't have children. We don't plan on having any kids. We have, you know, a couple friends that are, you know, working on their third and fourth. We have friends that are very happy being single and, you know, having their ashes tossed off a cruise ship. So, you know, there's all these different people out there. So let's kind of maybe look at the front end of that. If you're talking to someone that's maybe a single professional, you know, how do those kind of goals differ? Because it's going to be a market difference. If, you know, that person doesn't have children, X, Y, and Z, what are some of the goals that you look at if you look at, you know, a single person that is coming in and really wants to hammer down on financial planning?
Yeah. And it changes the conversation completely. Some single people still want to talk about leaving money to nephews and stuff, but it's not a priority in the same way. They always have more money, the single people. I'm telling you that as a mother of three, the people who are single always have more money. So they really are just making sure that they can live the life that they want to live. I mean, they generally don't need life insurance. You know, they often though will ask about long-term care, and that comes up a lot because if they're alone, they want to make sure there's money to cover their long-term care expenses. Even if they have enough to self-fund, a lot of single people want it as that protection, you know, so that they can choose where they need to go if they have care. They can bring somebody in if they need care. So long-term care for single people is a discussion that really resonates with a lot of them. In, you know, you don't buy this when you're in your 30s, you buy in your 50s and later. You know, their goals are different. I mean, there's usually a big travel budget in there. And it's mostly when I'm done, not in this world, when I'm done working, do I have enough? Because it's just me. I got to manage everything on my own. A lot of times we have couples these days that aren't married. And so they may be a couple, but there's a lot of discussions about property, who owns what. What happens if one has kids and the other one doesn't and they own property jointly? We have to plan really smartly to where that property is going to go and make sure there's documentation so we don't have arguments with the children of the one that's deceased and the girlfriend or boyfriend that's left behind. So, you know, there's definitely planning to be done there. We want to make sure that's taken care of. What else? Oh, divorce. Again, we've got a lot of divorce plans. And divorce, when we start working with them, if it's early on, there's a few clients, I think there's three the last year where they were just in the stages of they're planning their divorce. And we did a lot of running of scenarios for them. And they were on both sides. We had people getting and receiving child support, getting and receiving alimony. So we helped them figure out what they needed that number to be. You know, the courts decide some of it, but they wanted to go into it saying, listen, I know that I need, making this up, $2,000 a month for child support to make this work. If I get that, I know I'm going to be good. Or I had a woman who was going back to work and she's like, how much do I need to make to be on my own? Assuming I get half the assets and no alimony, there was no kids. So we played a lot around with, okay, you need to get a job making this much in order to make this work. You're going to get half the assets. They need to grow at this rate of return. To get you to, you know, so you can support yourself. One thing we haven't talked about with all this, so all this numbers about getting to your goals, you know, how are we getting there, right? We're investing money. We're not putting our money under the mattress. So we plan with very conservative rates of return, but we try to do better than that. And we help them with their investment. You know, all planners will help you with their investment allocations, how the money's going to be invested, what type of accounts. And that's a crucial part because people come to us a lot of times with, you know, an old IRA and a 401k here and an inherited account here. And they're like, they all have different rules. They all have different tax rules. And so we have to build that into the plan, and we have to make sure that the allocation makes sense, right? So if you have three different accounts and three different people are looking at it, they're not talking to each other. You may end up having all your money in large growth stocks, which is very, very common. We like you to be diversified, but if one person isn't looking at anything, there's no plan for that money. So to make all these goals work, the underlying investments have to be aligned as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to go back a touch, and then we'll touch on the investments and the like in a moment. But one thing I find, unfortunately, and I use the word interesting just as a general thing of just something that is there, not to pass judgment on it one way or another. But the unfortunate part about divorce is that typically in any relationship, it's not a 50-50 split of looking at finances. It is not saying, hey, like, oh, I did the accounting on the credit card this month and I looked at the investments. Next month it's you. I'm taking care of this. It's normally one person kind of steering that ship. Absolutely. So when you have a divorce that comes about, you typically are going to have one person that is, you know, knows where everything is done, has their own plan, and they just have to adjust accordingly for having, you know, basically one income stream done if it's, you know, a W-2 type couple. But you oftentimes have someone that is, again, kind of been stuck in this boat and, you know, doesn't know how to rig the sail, doesn't know, you know, which direction to go. So, you know, and that can be probably a little bit problematic and tough for a financial planner, because you're going to be talking to someone that is, you know, in their 30s, 40s, or 50s that, you know, is in the second half, or at least, you know, done a good amount of living, that has really no bearing on maybe even some of the basics of, you know, finance. Maybe haven't even ever set up a checking account for themselves, you know, depending on when they, you know, got married. So what are some of the kind of things that you try to help people with in that scenario? You know, because it can probably be tough to talk to someone about, you know, the basics of finance. That's, you know, maybe a 45 or 55 year old divorcee. You know, it has to be a kind of a tough position for you to be in, to one, be, you know, sympathetic to the position that they're in, and two, make sure that you get them on track quickly.
Yeah, education is a big piece of what we do. It's a big piece. And women aren't afraid to ask. Women are much more, are more open to asking than the men are generally. But no, it's a big deal. I'd say it's a bigger deal with a little bit older demographic where they maybe haven't done anything. The older people, it's definitely, there's a lot of older divorced women that, you know, never looked at their stuff. We see it less with the younger divorcees, but, you know, it's just a huge part of it. It's just a big part of the conversation. You know, that first call is all about why, what do you need? And if they are like, I know nothing. Like, okay, let's get, the only way I can help though is to see everything. You got to try to find everything. You got to show me all the accounts or tell me all the accounts. And usually I need to see it, because so many times someone says, I have a 401k, and it turns out it's a brokerage account, or the titling makes a lot of difference. So I like to see all the statements and talk about the income. And to be honest, this is where my comment about the tax return comes in. I taught a workshop once for women who were getting divorced or had been widowed. And the tax return is a treasure trove of information to find stuff, to find where you have accounts, where you have money. And so if if it's not a pleasant divorce, it can get a little tricky getting all the information, and the lawyers often have to help with that. But let's assume we can get all the information. We just spend a lot of time talking to them about what's what and trying to ease their fears and speak to them, you know, like intelligent human beings that they are, not down to anybody. And it just takes time, you know. That's why we do financial planning. Like, we take a lot of time. You know, sometimes we're doing 4 or 5 calls in those first couple months just to get people comfortable with where they are and let them know that they can ask any question.
Yeah, and that's a big part, especially when it comes to, you know, women in divorce, is just the amount of disenfranchisement that is, you know, it around finance. You know, I tell anyone, it doesn't matter who you are coming to me, it's like, ask questions, do research. You know, there shouldn't be any type of stigma around this stuff, because ultimately, especially after divorce, that onus is put on you. You know, you don't have that other person to rely on. And if you got divorced, maybe there's a reason, you know, for everything that went on. And, you know, taking back some of that, you know, franchise can be very empowering to a lot of people. But you have to know the questions to ask, and you have to do the research. Past just talking to a, you know, financial planner such as yourself, that can be certainly a great resource. What are some maybe kind of, you know, low hanging fruit, some easy access to, you know, educate yourself and before you kind of answer that, the thing that I tell anyone, and I kind of give this disclaimer, is be cognizant of your source. You know, understand what the impetus for why this person is giving you this information. Just because someone has a vested interest in, you know, making money on the decisions that you make with that information doesn't mean it's bad. But you should always understand why this person is giving you the information. What do they have to gain from you consuming this information and ultimately making actions on it? Again, everyone's got to eat, you know, and you shouldn't be just saying, oh, well, this person has this that they're offering, or they're a service provider. I shouldn't use that. You know, I need to only use free stuff. It's not the case.
But
again, always be cognizant of where this stuff is coming from and why they are giving you that information.
Yeah.
But if maybe they're not ready to take the step, because divorce can be certainly traumatic for many people. So some low-hanging fruit, maybe they're not ready to kind of take that step and talk to someone like you. What are some good educational resources people can utilize?
You know, I when you talk about hiring a professional too, I do think sometimes your attorneys usually is often a good resource, because they should know who has helped their clients in the past. Gosh, free resources. I get to think about that. I don't know if I have anything on the tip of my tongue that I would
say. Well, not necessarily free, just good places to start. Do you and I always find this so cheesy, and I hate to ask a question, but is there a good book that you might recommend to kind of get someone's feet wet? I always find it incredibly odd when podcasters are like, give me 5 books that you read that you love. But again,
and I read so many books on the Kindle, I forget the name of them, which is terrible. they need to be bigger at the bottom. I can't think of a book off the top of my head. I will tell you, when I started getting into finance, I read Kiplinger's all the time. The Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine. Forbes is too corporate. It's got great articles, but it's not the place to start. Kiplinger had a lot of personal finance stuff that I found helpful to read. You know, Investopedia and NerdWallet online actually don't do a bad job at all, just with the basics. But nobody tells you the details. So I read them and I'm like, oh my God, they forgot those 7 exceptions. So it's not the end. It's a starting point. Just remember that.
Exactly. Yeah. And just like you know, you can get a lot of great information out there, but at the end of the day, you know, if you have something wrong with your health, you go to a doctor. You know, it's, you know, kind of treat your finances like your health. And ultimately, you know, there's a direct correlation, whether people want to admit it's not, to financial well-being and health well-being. You know, stress is a killer.
Direct connection to those who work with advisors have more success. I mean, it's when I meet with a client, and if they're hesitant to hire us, I often can, it's very telling if they've never hired a professional, like they were their own contractor for their job. They didn't do the work, but they were like their GC, you know, they do all their own, you know, they use LegalZoom. I'm like, oh, this is not, you know, this client's going to have trouble hiring me if they do everything themselves. The ones that have had trusted advisors before and know the value of them, they're easier to accept people's, you know, advice.
Yeah. And I would parrot that point of saying, you know, just because we have so much technology and there's so much access to do what you want to do, whether that's legal through LegalZoom, whether that's robo advising through Fidelity or Schwab or something like that, you can take, again, a good amount of franchise in anything in life while not having to talk to anyone. But there's a reason that professionals in my arena, and there's professionals in your arena, there's people that, you know, enjoy doing this. You know, I use that term enjoy lightly. We all have bad days at work, but there's a reason that you and I are doing the jobs we do and not something else. There is an inherent amount of either expertise or enjoyment, and hopefully a good mixture of both, that professionals can bring. And, you know, a computer is not going to just, you know, understand, you know, the intricacies of your goals. You know, you plug in a few different questions, but if, you know, if you ask the person the question, say, hey, like, you know, do you want to leave money to your children or XYZ? And they're kind of, you know, they really perk up at the aspect of funding and education, but they, you know, it's like, do you want to take a vacation? Well, yeah, sure. I like taking vacations. You know, you don't get that intricacy of figuring out, okay, this person really has goals that, you know, they answered yes, but did they really? Did they really answer yes? And the answer is, the answer is no.
Yeah.
So don't be afraid to hire a professional. You know, it's, you know, you're going to have to pay for a service, but ultimately, you know, just like in divorce, you pay for an attorney. You know, divorce, going through a divorce pro se is, you know, unless you are an attorney, maybe not the best idea, or anything in life. So to that point, unless you have anything you want to add to that.
No,
Okay. So, and again, I know, at least in our pre-call, and especially with myself, you know, asking about investments always has to be a very high level conversation. You know, we're not going to get into saying, hey, if you're single or if you're married or if you're divorced, you know, here's the investments that you should be investing in. You know, that's not the goal of our conversation today, and it's certainly not what we're going to get into. So, but it's important to kind of at least cover the topic. We can cover, you know, saying, hey, you know, having a financial plan is great. But, you know, people want to know what is out there to invest in. So on a high level, you know, what are some things that, you know, different people should, you know, be looking at? Or what are some things that, you know, you kind of broach the topic of saying, hey, like, here's some of these different products out there. You know, the single people probably don't look at life insurance. The, you know, married couple that is, you know, strong foundation that has children, you know, probably life insurance is good to kind of have within that plan. So again, on a high level, maybe since we're kind of covering, you know, those three different buckets, single, married, and, you know, newly single or divorced, what are some different types of investments that, you know, people should look at or at least be aware, and maybe some that, you know, work to some of those goals?
Right. So I'm going to talk first about the type of accounts, and then people get confused about this all the time. I'll say to a client, what do you have? What do you invest in? They're like, an IRA. I'm like, well, an IRA is a wrapper. It's not an investment.
So that's like, I invest in a checking account. Oh, yeah, that's exactly. That's not common.
And again, the laws keep getting more confusing. So now we have regular IRAs, we have SEP IRAs, we have Roth IRAs, we have Roth 401ks, regular 401ks. And I'm not even getting into all the inherited options, but.
Well, and you know, as of last year, now we have Roth SEP IRAs. We have Roth Simple IRAs.
Yes.
We have so many more, and the IRS still hasn't given us reporting codes on how to even actually do those from the custodial side. No, we can't even open them, but
they got to give us more guidance on the Department of Distributions on the inherited accounts. So anyway, but big picture, I mean, saving for retirement, it almost for everybody is on their list somewhere, right? So do it. Do it early and young. My kids, my 19-year-old already opened his first Roth IRA. And so, yep. Not my 21-year-old, but my 19-year-old.
Well, you got to, at least you have, you've cracked the armor at least. And maybe they'll get a little sibling jealousy and be like, they have an IRA, I need an IRA.
So, you know, understanding the difference between the Roth, which is after-tax savings compared to regular IRAs, and the parallel world in the 401k, Roth 401k versus regular 401k. You know, if you have access to these at work, put money in them. Put the small, just put something in. If your company matches, try to put in as much so you get the match. A match is free money. It's the company putting money into your account for you, free. But you have to usually contribute to do it. So try, that's where I always have people start. And if you're young, do understand, or anybody should kind of try to take a time to understand the difference between the pre-tax regular stuff and the post-tax Roth. Because in retirement, when you do finally retire, they're taxed differently. And it's nice to have money in both of them. It gives you a lot of flexibility. So in really simple terms, you save money in retirement on a Roth. You pay no taxes on a Roth in retirement, but you don't save tax money today. And the regular is the opposite. So we could spend a whole call on that, but I try to get people to see if they can use both those accounts. I'll also mention cash. You know, right now, people always have too much cash in the bank, it seems like. If you have cash and it's emergency money, which is great, you should have 3 months or so of emergency money. Nowadays, you can get decent interest rates, but you can't get it at the big banks. There's a lot of places to get it. So do your research. You can go online and search best places to get, you know, high interest savings account. Don't park your money anymore at 0.1%. You can get better interest rates on short-term money. So it's just a little thing. For 10 years, we had such low interest rates. Nobody paid any attention and it didn't matter, but it does now. So these are some of the basics. And then when you get into what's underneath, what's inside these 401ks or these IRAs or these regular just brokerage accounts, you know, we have stocks, bonds, and how do you invest in stocks, bonds? You can buy them individually, or you can buy them through a mutual fund or an exchange traded fund. I mean, those are the simple big categories. And there's the whole adage of being, you know, diversified, having something, you don't want to have all your money in one stock. So a lot of people start with these exchange traded funds that are really broadly diversified, and they may own 500 stocks. And it's a great way to start when you don't have a lot of money and you're trying to be diversified. So, you know, this is where doing a little research and you Google asset allocation and get an understanding of why you do it. It spreads your risk out. You should get, you know, better rates of return and less volatility, but you have to be diversified and you have to look at the different buckets. And it can get very, very granular from, you can just do stocks and bonds, and then stocks themselves break down into large company, small company, growth, value. it gets very granular. So this is something that if you want to teach yourself, you can find so much online to read about this. But this is something that we do as professionals. We look at that. We make sure you're diversified. You're never in just, as we say, the proverbial one bucket.
Yeah, sure. And that's, and to your point as well, is understanding the inherent benefit of using some investments in one type of asset versus another one. And it also kind of plays a lot into tax planning as well. That's a big thing that some people don't realize is that, you know, to the point that I talk to some people, and again, you know, we strictly give zero financial advice on the professional side of what we do as asset custodians. But too often people kind of don't realize what the inherent tax implication of a particular investment might be. And again, I understand professionally from your side, that's not something we're going to get into too much of the weeds on, but at least it's a good thing to understand that, you know, yes, you know, like you said, should you save money in these plans? Yes. The answer is just, you know, it's like, if you haven't, use it, the simple answer. And when it comes down to, you know, okay, saying, okay, well, you know, I have rainy day funds, or I'm going to start doing investing with my personal taxable money, understanding what some of the tax consequences from that can be are very important. Because if you want to kind of try to invest in stuff, at least personally, where you have so many more tax considerations, understanding what some of the tax implications from the investments that you're making can throw off are incredibly important. And if one of your goals is to be, you know, very streamlined and, you know, keep, you know, just keep everything as simple as possible, if you get invested into something that has, you know, maybe an incredibly long lockup or is highly illiquid or throws off stuff that has very different taxation schedules, you know, that can be very problematic as well. And understanding maybe where some investments are better suited to other types of accounts, not just saying, hey, I like this investment, let's do it. You know, maybe you should do that investment through an IRA. Maybe you should do that investment personally because it gives you the ability to write stuff off on your personal taxes. That's where some of the granular knowledge of a professional really comes in, I feel like, is having someone that can say, okay, look, yes, this investment, okay, cool. It makes sense for you, but maybe not just in the sense that you should go out and take your checking account and stroke a check for it. You have money here that might be better suited to that. Now, what kind of, at what point do you feel like people kind of get to that level? You know, it's probably not your, you know, much younger clients, if then, unless they, you know, are highly compensated. But where do you start kind of having, you know, those more in-depth conversations? Because, you know, you have to build something. I feel like we're, you know, getting towards the top of the pyramid. When do you start kind of having some of those more, you know, drill down past the goals into really the, you know, implications of the actions that you're making for your plans?
Yeah, it's definitely when you've accumulated some assets. Because if you're just saving in a retirement account, it's, and you're, you know, we're telling you, we're saying do 50% Roth and 50%, you know, regular. And you're, you know, you don't have any outside savings really to speak of besides emergency money. There's not much really you can do. But as you start accumulating money, and like you said, you decide where to put it. Like when we have clients that bring money over and we have different strategies, you know, we have small stock and large cap and fixing, we have all different types of strategies. Everybody does. And so we may decide based on if it's pre-tax dollars, if it's in a retirement account, or if it's a regular brokerage account, which ones to put in which, depending on the kind of income that they throw off. So you have to have the different buckets. You have to have enough money outside of retirement dollars to make that decision. Because inside retirement dollars, it's either Roth or not. And none of them are taxed during your accumulation phase. So as you're accumulating in a Roth or a 401k or an IRA, there's no taxation annually. So we can be, if that's all the money you have, there's not much discussion to happen. It happens when you get older and you have to take money out. But if you have money outside of a regular IRA, regular 401k or Roth, then there's a lot more conversation of what you're putting your money in because it's going to have tax consequences. You sell a stock inside a regular brokerage account during the year, you have a tax event. And then there's things like tax loss harvesting that we can do. So, you know, I'm not going to get into that, but there's tax plan. There's a lot more tax planning when you have money outside of retirement accounts. And that's where you get into it. And of course, if you have investment real estate, I mean, real estate is, I did a course recently on real estate. I mean, I don't know how many pages were in it. It was huge. Real estate tax planning. I mean, it's endless. The deductions, the depreciation. I mean, this is just, it's a whole can of worms. It's more in your world, but there's a whole bunch of stuff to plan for. And you really want to consult a professional when you have real estate and investment property. It's the whole tax. It's a different tax code, basically, this whole other section.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And that's really important to understand is from the perspective of saying, you know, what you're doing and, you know, understanding the tax back end of it. Because when it comes to actually you know, doing any of this. And, you know, the old adage definitely rings true. It's not how much you make, it's how much you keep. You know, if you have all this savings and you're investing and you said, oh, I made all these returns, but you day traded everything in your personal name and now all of your gains are subjected to ordinary income tax, then, well, okay, great. But you're going to shave off at least 20% to the government on everything. So, you know, it's like, okay, I made, you know, 28% of my money in the year. That's awesome. But did you really only net out enough to basically give a point above inflation? You know, that might be the real context of yeah. what you're talking about. And understanding where some of those actions are better suited to you, again, is very important. And that's something that doesn't bleed over into my world as much, being in the you know, alternative space, which are much longer planned assets in tax qualified and tax shelters. But on the broader context of what we're talking about, again, understanding what your actions mean, and not just from the perspective of saying, okay, well, I need to take action and save more, or I need to be able to put things in different buckets. Actions have consequences, not just in the immediacy of setting up a plan, but also what the, you know, implementation of that plan can be, and, you know, trying to make sure that one, you stick to it, and two, don't just say, hey, great, I got this big architecture, but now I'm shooting myself in the foot because I didn't realize that the government's going to come knocking every April saying, well, you did great, but so did we.
You know, so I'm going to just clarify one of the things you said. So your listeners, so there's a difference between short-term gains and long-term gains, and they're taxed very differently. And that's what Alex is referring to. And when you're trading things in and out quickly, you pay taxes differently than if you hold it for longer. So there could be some great planning to do. You know where else I see this a lot, and this isn't in trading, but in selling a home. The rules on selling a home and what you pay the capital gains on have changed. I forget what year they changed. A while ago now, but so many people still think it's the old rules. But you can exclude $250,000 of capital gains when you sell your primary home, as long as you meet a few rules, mostly that you owned it and lived in it for two of the past 5 years. If you're a couple, it's doubled. But people have so much confusion over this rule and how do you calculate the gain? And if a spouse dies, there's some special rules to help you. So these are really important things to talk to somebody about, because these are big numbers, especially I live in the Northeast. I mean, and how much the property is appreciated. These can be huge gains. So you really want to think about, you know, what you're doing. And if you sell a home while you're alive versus if you pass it on when you die, huge, huge tax differences. So,
yeah. Yes. Really IRS code 121 is a really powerful tool for a lot of people. And not that people should kind of, you know, go and be like, I need to read tax code, unless you're a glutton for punishment.
Well,
like
if you're,
me.
You're an insomniac, it might help.
Yeah. If you're a glutton for punishment like me and you enjoy reading tax code, because I feel like it's the peek behind the curtains and it's the government saying, hey, here's how to pay us the least amount of money. We're going to make it extremely painful to read. You know, you'll need some band-aids for your eyeballs because they will bleed. But it's, again, it's just something where, you know, having to kind of harken back to the importance of having professionals that can help you is very important. Because, you know, you might hear that on a podcast, or you might read that in, you know, some type of article, whether that be on Forbes or, you know, Investopedia, NerdWallet, or somewhere. But to really kind of have the understanding of saying, okay, well, here's how this could affect me if I sell this house.
Yeah.
And maybe in the context, especially, you know, for people going through divorce and selling assets, how these tax codes can apply in different scenarios, because it's not just a catch-all saying, oh, if you bought a house in a primary residence, well, what happens then? You know, if you get divorced, you're taken off the deed, the house sales, and then is that money coming in going to be taxed different? It's, again, important things to kind of break down on a very specific level for that. And to the kind of ending points on all of this, I think, you know, the big one is, you know, talk to a professional, because there's a lot to kind of digest in all of this. But I always like to turn it back over to my guests at the end of these to say, you know, are there any specific points that you kind of feel like we missed or glossed over, or anything that you feel would be beneficial to the context of our conversation today? And then certainly if you have, you know, anything, any information for people to get in touch with you for professional services or anything else you have going on, you know, now's the kind of time to platform that.
I mean, we touched on a lot. I mean, the big thing is just if you don't know, find out where all your stuff is, find out where all your money is, find out where your income and expenses are, like get a handle on what's going on. It's like anything in life, you know, you'll do better if you understand where you are. So, and it like you said in the beginning, it's really hard to move forward. If you're going to plan for a marathon, you got to understand where you are today to how to train for it to get there, right? So your finances are very similar. So just take the time to understand it and don't be afraid to ask questions. But just make sure the person answering them has some knowledge.
Yeah, exactly. You understand who's on the other end of that line, right?
Well, we get a lot. My brother told me. I'm like, oh.
So. Is your brother a financial planner? No. Okay. Well.
But yeah, don't be afraid. It's not scary. The more you talk about it, the less scary it is.
No, exactly. And I would really echo that, is that just have the conversation. You know, we're, you know, anyone in finance, you know, we're friendly people. You know, at the end of the day, the ones that have your best interest at heart, you know, we're happy to have a conversation. You know, there's always a figuring out and aligning of goals to make sure that, you know, whoever you're talking to is aligned with what you're looking to do. And don't always be afraid to, you know, talk to multiple different people. You know, the service that we do here at Advanta IRA is very specialized. I tell people, you know, more than once a week, say, hey, look, like, here's what we do. As much as I'd love to kind of have you as a client, you know, make sure this is, you know, aligned with your goals and this is a good fit, before, you know, we kind of sit down at the table and eat together. It's, you know, don't always necessarily go with the first one. Talk to people, make sure you're comfortable with them, because if you're going to turn over the keys to your financial kingdom to someone, make sure you're comfortable with them. If, you know, just, it's at a very simple level. You know, it's, you know, you're not going to date someone that you hate. Well, hopefully not. But you know, it goes back down to that. You're forming a relationship with someone. And you have to make sure that it's going to be beneficial and that you, you know, quote unquote, like the person that you're dealing with. So with that said, any final thoughts? And then also, if they want to get in touch with you, how can they reach you?
Yeah. So my LinkedIn's, you know, easiest. It's Lisa Prosta at LinkedIn. The website for work is bppwealth.com. You can find all of our information there as well.
All right. Well, Lisa, thank you so much for being on with us today. I always appreciate people spending their most precious asset with which is their time with us, because it's the one thing you can never make more of, no matter how much you save. Okay. With that said, my name is Alex Perney. As always, this has been the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast, and thank you for joining.
Thank you for tuning in to the Alternative Investing Advantage podcast. Tune in next week for more investing tips and strategies.
Want to hear more episodes of the Alternative Investing Advantage? Search podcast at advantaira.com and subscribe.